Welcome to Endless 08, a time loop anime podcast. I'm Duffo.
I'm BJ.
It is 2008. We are watching and discussing anime from 2008, the year that it is.
And it's such a good year.
Due to a rift in the space-time continuum, we are joined by a guest. Etten, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Etten. I make tabletop role-playing games, including Breakfast Cult, Hard White Island, and Oh Dang, Bigfoot Stole My Car with my friend's birthday present inside, which got played by the Macroways, so I have to mention it now.
Yes.
And in 2008, I was the events director at a university anime club, so that's my credentials for this.
Yeah, incredibly qualified.
An actual experience. Oh my God. This is amazing.
That's great. So you can picture it. Can you describe this anime club to us? Like, take us back there. This is part of our 2008 immersion section of the show.
Yes. So let's see. It was a Sydney University. The club scene there was very normal. For example, there's a club called Sutek, which was the general pop culture club, and it was named after the villain from an old Doctor Who serial, because all clubs had to start with SU back then for some reason, and just over time people kept coming up with more specific clubs, like the anime club, for example. They just kind of got peeled off it, more or less. So the anime club was just, we watched anime once a week. We had one specific table in the food court area that we hogged basically 24/7. And
you were watching anime at the food club table?
No, we booked rooms at the university to watch the anime in.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Because they had screens, and it was basically a lecture hall, but, you know, we're watching fucking Gurren Lagann, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I can imagine that being pretty good as a screen.
Yeah, yep. There's a part of me that's very, very jealous, 100%. There's also a part of me that's got some deep cringe happening right now.
I imagine you would have had some personalities there.
Yeah, some of them are still my friends, so I'm not going to shit talk them.
Good move.
Good decision.
But I could.
Cool. So, 2008, you've got many... You were showing me all of these DVDs you have from the time, just whole DVD stacks of, demos. Where did these come from?
That was someone else at the anime club. They just collected them. I think some of them were the stuff that we screened, but they went back nearly 10 years, so I didn't think it was all that. Just one day they were getting rid of them, and I said I'd take them.
Yeah.
Would get them out and check the titles, but the last time I picked it up, half the CD spindle crumbled, so... But I did mention that I did leave these out, because I think you said you might be interested in. They are anime sampler DVDs from Mad Men.
Wow.
In 2008.
Yeah, a lot of these are coming out of, magazines or...
Yeah.
Being sent out by producers.
There's, some basically full-length episodes from a bunch of anime back then, plus... trailers.
That's exactly what I want, to watch an episode of an anime, probably halfway through it, not knowing what's going on. Yeah!
Oh, hey, there's actually episodes of a podcast called Anime Snack Time on this.
Oh, no. Are we going to have to listen to those and do a review?
Yeah, I'm going to have to find the competition here.
Yeah.
Authentic 2008 anime podcast. Just imagine. You've come on today. You specifically wanted to watch something not good. You put out an X post or whatever it is now, asking for some feedback.
No, it's 2008. It's still a tweet.
It's still a tweet. And
It went okay. I think a lot of the replies were too terrible.
Oh, yeah. Strike Witches, I'm so not looking forward to watching.
Okay, cool. I every time I look at the list, I just try and close it as soon as I can, because I'm like, there's going to be trash on here. I don't want to know. I'm just...
I pulled it up here.
Well, Televeru is also on this list, so I just the less I have to see of that reminding me, the better.
Strike Witches, Ikki Tosen, Code Geass.
Yeah.
We have two Tower of Gerardas, whatever that is.
Wait, is there two of it?
Two people suggested it.
Oh, sorry. I was sitting here thinking, I can't watch another one of this. I just can't.
I believe the way that they phrased it was, it's the blandest thing you'll ever watch 12 episodes of.
Wow,
someone
what an accurate
pitched,
assessment.
Queen's Blade, and I feel very strongly that no.
So Tower of Jirago is, yeah, recommended to us on this merit, and I would say it has lived up to it. I have some production notes I would like to run through before we get into the show.
Please.
So, yes. Yeah, this has an interesting background. It is based on a video game from 1984. This is an old Namco arcade game called The Tower of Jirago. It's pitched as, I've seen it listed multiple times, as being a fantasy Pac-Man.
Oh.
Which I guess at the time was the best way to compare that to what everyone else is doing.
Considering this is so early on in gaming, like, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a game where there are all these levels of, like, a dungeon tower that you're going through. It looks very Legend of Zelda, although it is actually a precursor and a direct inspiration to Legend of Zelda.
Oh, didn't know that.
Okay. Where this little man is going around with this sword. You should both be pretty familiar with how this game plays, because there is an entire episode of this show that is dedicated to them sitting down at an arcade cabinet and playing this game.
And and this is where I embarrass myself immensely by stating that I didn't realize this was based on a video game until the very end, when I got mad at the ending and then had decided to look up what comes next. And then it says, Tower of Jirago, based on the hit 1989 whatever video game. And I went, oh, so that's why there were all those weird game segments. That makes so much more sense.
Yeah. Actually, did you watch the end segments? Like, they have the end credits, and then afterward, there's a character scene. Here's what's happening in the next episode.
Yes.
Fuck no.
I did, yes.
Okay, there was one where it was the creator of the game doing that.
he did
a little dance. It was good.
The end sections were largely done in that 16-bit style.
Right.
Was it 8-bit? I think it would technically be 8-bit. Yes. So this got its... like, it was a very big Japanese thing for ages. It got, you know, many, many sequels. There was a theme park ride that was installed in Expo 90, which was Tower of Jirago themed. But largely, like, it didn't make it over to the West until the game was released in 2009.
Hang on. It's a game that hasn't come out yet.
That is correct. This... anime here is a lead up to it being released in the West.
What? Who wants that? Yeah, I understand this is a foundational game, whatnot. Yeah, okay, cool. But, like, what's the audience for a precursor Zelda game that doesn't function very well?
I can tell you right now, it did very badly. This got, like, a 3 out of 10 from all the gaming publications once it was out.
There we go.
can't believe that.
A large part of the problem is that it's not designed to be a game you sit down and play by yourself. Japanese arcade places at the time, they used to have these communal notebooks that people would leave by machines.
Yeah.
And as you were playing a game, you fill out all of the stuff you figured out and you leave it for the next person who comes in and sits down and works on it themselves.
Right. So that explains that segment of the show when they're doing the arcade segment, where that book came from. Like, I had assumed watching it, like, Japanese video games have always had, like... handbooks and stuff that, like, the game, the Final Fantasy guide, things like that, that tell you how to, you know, do all the things and whatnot. I didn't put together that was actually a community-based thing, not, like, I assume it was just published by the publisher, like, by the creators, and you're like, there you go, here's how to play the game.
I thought it was those third-party strategy guides that used to get published, if you remember those.
Yes.
Yep. One of those.
Like a Prima or whoever.
Yeah, it's nicer that it's a community-based thing. Like, that's a Japanese cultural element that I didn't know about. Because, obviously, I wasn't in Japan in the 80s when arcade games were a thing. I wasn't born.
No, and you go over there now and the arcade machines are, like, they've got wands and spinning wheels.
Yeah,
and
the arcade machines are just the rhythm games, and they're just filled with sweaty, not, like, sweaty as in, like, oh, that guy stinks, but, like, sweaty people who are getting their monthly, daily, like, unbelievable amount of exercise from being immensely skilled at these rhythm games, just throwing their hands everywhere or doing the taiko drum game. And I'm like, I don't understand what's going on.
You don't have the athleticism to keep up there.
I don't have the mental capacity to keep up with what's on the screen and what they're doing, because it's so fast, my mind is not keeping up. It's beautiful, but I don't fucking get it.
Moving over to the anime, this was produced by Gonzo. They're a studio we haven't touched yet. They are made of former Gainax employees.
Oh, no.
I think, well, one of their first big early hits is Afro Samurai.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, that's the tier of early stuff that they're doing.
Wow, they went downhill.
Well, by the time we get to 2008, they are putting out things like Strike Witches. They are putting out Rosario Vampire.
Oh, no. Oh,
which we are going to watch both seasons of.
Oh, God.
Have fun with that.
And this is one of their more serious ones. As they come at this, this has a unique release style. So they do a deal with some subscription services. There's a service called GYAO over in Japan, and they make a deal with Crunchyroll in America. This is the first show to ever be simulcast.
Okay.
Ooh, hello.
That's breaking some ground. Unfortunate it was this trash, but hey, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, that's how, like, most stuff comes out on Crunchyroll these days. Of course, it was a bit different because Crunchyroll at the time was just, like, mostly just illegally hosted fan subs. And the way they actually released this, because they couldn't charge subscriptions at the time, it was a pay-what-you-want donation to access the episodes of Tower of Druaga.
Okay. Wow, that's... Right.
People paid money for it.
Because we've talked about Crunchyroll before and their kind of history in 2008, as you said, like, they were just hosting bullshit.
Yeah, and they, like, don't go legit until pretty much 2009.
So like, this was an October show, wasn't it? I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Dang. All right. So they're getting somewhere at the end of 2008. I thought it was just bullshit right up until like 2009. But you know what? If they landed this, dang.
Yeah. Final notes on this. The main director attached to this is Koichi Chigara of Full Metal Panic fame. But there are a bunch of other people attached to this. IMDb has 7 other directors who came in, and most of them only worked on one episode each.
Oh my god, that explains stuff.
Yeah, it does.
It does, but also, honestly, for having that many directors obviously doing it for different episodes, surprisingly cohesive.
I wouldn't say so. Like, this to me feels like an Exquisite Corpse game. It feels like each director came in only having seen the episode before.
Yeah, no. I should be a bit clearer. Consistent in the sense that it's all bland and bad. I didn't have a standout moment. Like, it was all consistently, oh, this is just kind of uninspired. And that's surprising to me. I would have expected people have got one guy who's like, let's do this thing. It's going to be weird and different and cool. But no, it was all just kind of like, meh, equally meh.
I mean, again, this probably would have done numbers in 2008, at least in the anime club.
Yeah. I'm also wondering.
I should stop riffing on these guys.
No, do it. I'm also wondering if, like, the reason that these people are in on this is probably someone calling in favors. Wait, I helped you out with that one. Quick, I need you to direct this episode for me.
Yeah, I can believe that, actually. Etten, do you want to describe the show for us? Tell us the plot, what exists.
All right, I can do that. Okay, so where do I start? All right, so besides what you said, the premise of Tower of Druaga is that, although there's obviously a massive tower with an evil god at the top of it, and at the bottom of it there's like a city full of humans living out their peaceful lives, and sometimes they become adventurers and go into the tower and die, or sometimes they join the military who go into the tower and die.
There are so many fucking soldiers in this.
Yeah. I got comments about that later. So this is about a guy called Jill. Spelled with one L and a J, which is definitely a normal name, who wants to become a hero by ascending the tower and killing Druaga. Then he just sort of assembles a crew of adventurers and goes up there along with a ton of other adventurers in the military. And there's, you know, there's monster fights, there's political intrigue, there's bathing scenes, there's Koopa, I guess. There's the arcade episode, there's, you know, frills and spills and all this other stuff, and a sequel hook. And it's all, you know, the tower concept was probably fairly new back then, I think. Like, these days, I could name a million webtoons off the top of my head alone that have a tower that adventurers climb, but I don't think there were that many back then, were there?
No, I think, so this show would have been landmark, well, the game would have been landmark in a couple ways. Yep. That it introduced this idea. It was supposedly the first game to ever have journals in it. The idea of a journal that you open that has information about what you've done so far.
Okay.
Which stock standard in every game. And it's also, he wanted to do something different when creating it, and so used Mesopotamian mythology, and which, yes. it's kind of seeped into Japanese culture, and like the Fate franchise has picked this up, and like most people know Gilgamesh and Ishtar and these other names if you've watched anime before. Jill is supposed to be short for Gilgamesh.
But it's not. Like, this is so weird because, like, the first episode, depending on how you watched it, our main character, Jill, has a dream sequence that is the plot of the video game. Yes. I'm pretty sure. And in that, like, the plot of the video game is the character called Gilgamesh went and, you know, conquered the tower, whatever, saved the princess, whatever the fuck happened. I hated that episode so much. Then we've got our new character, Jill. And I just, like, I understand that basically what they're doing is, like, you know, they could both start with G, but, like, it's weird because in Japanese, like, for me, at least in Japanese, like, there is, like, any G sounds are a G, and the sound G and the sound J are, like, completely separated from each other. There's no way you could really get them anywhere near each other. It's just, I felt like that took too much of a leap to get. It's never expanded on. Like, we've got this idea that, okay, so we had Gilgamesh to, like, rose the tower originally, whatever, cool. And then we've got this new guy, but this new guy doesn't have, you know, the blessing of Ishtar or anything like that. He's just a schlub. What's our thematic connection here? His name's similar? Wow!
The show does try and make a point of that and saying, oh, you know, these climbers are just kind of self-interested people who, you know, mostly just after money or whatever the hell else, but they still manage to do something amazing when they come together and work in the same direction, if not as a team.
Yeah.
But that's not what the original game was about. Like, I don't know.
Original game's about a dude with a sword walking around in circles.
Yeah, honestly.
And that dude's name is Gilgamesh.
Yeah, and this is so not...
Technically, this is a sequel too.
Which annoys me. This is not the foundation to build a show on. This is nothing.
We'll come back around on that first episode. Because this was simulcast, there were actually two first episodes of this made. There was one with the dream sequence, and there is one that shows everything that happened in the real dungeon while they're carrying his unconscious body around and he's muttering to himself.
I did not see that one, by the way.
Oh, it's fine.
It doesn't matter that you haven't seen it, but I'm going to be honest, that alternate episode was just so much better. Honestly, they took a whole... All right, I'm going to rant about the first episode. They took the entire episode to tell us the story of the original game badly, jokingly, but not in a funny way. That was probably the bit that gets me the most, that they were trying to be jokey about it and be funny and what... It was not funny. It was not fun. It was not enjoyable.
Yeah.
It felt like a waste of my time. And whereas the alternate episode, like, you could have chunked that, like, original game plot into a single scene and then just had the rest of the alternate episode going, because that was the more interesting stuff. We got to learn about the original party that he was with, and we got to see their personalities come out. They're not good personalities, but they're more interesting than the bullshit jokes that were happening in the dream sequence. And there was a moment in the dream sequence when listening to it, I don't know if you listened to the English dub or the Japanese dub. Japanese dub. Okay, in the Japanese dub, please tell me how it was in the English dub. There were a number of moments where I could tell that the voice actor for Jill, who was, like, narrating the thing as it went, I could hear the cringe in his voice. He knew that this was bad. Unbelievably so. Like, he knew it. And
English sub was very earnest, I think.
Yeah, he leaned into it. So what I was going to say about the dub, basically, just to be clear, because I don't think we got into, like, the specifics of this, the premise of the first episode is it starts off in the real world and then some stuff happens, they get into a fight, and then after that, it gets increasingly silly, and it's, like, talking about Jill's backstory and all that stuff, and it's just cliche after cliche, but then it starts to get ridiculous, like, characters say, by the way, after this fight, I'm gonna go home and get married for no reason, and then they fucking die. And then, by the end, it's completely ridiculous, and then it turns out it was a dream the whole time. Ooh. But this, at least in the English dub, the impression I got was, it felt like an abridged series. Well, actually, it felt like a story, but apart from that, it felt like a niche series. But specifically, do you know the Soup Store meme? Like, the clip from the Code Geass series?
No, literally no idea whatsoever.
Okay, so there's an abridged series called Code Mentz, and it's like an abridged version of Code Geass,
yeah,
right?
Yep, yep.
And there's a really, really well-known clip from that, which is just about a character trying to go buy something at the store, but the only thing he can find is soup. I'm not going to explain the sketch because it's not funny if I just say it, but it's really good and it's really funny. And then if you watch the episode it came from, there is a full-on N-word. And that is the specific vibe that I got from the first episode.
Okay.
Because there was that there was that one scene, and knowing that this is a dream the character is having recontextualizes this a lot, I think. But there's that one scene where one of the members of the adventuring party, like specifically Fitina, the woman, gets attacked by a tentacle monster, and then the joke is that the dream version of Nebra is like, no, wait, don't save her yet. Wait for it. We've got to wait for it to get to the bit. And why was that scene so long?
Yeah. Yeah. This is what I'm talking about. They wasted so much of my time. Like, I could get it as, like, a funny gag for 20 seconds. It lasted a couple minutes. It was not short.
Yeah, and it's just him saying, wait for it, like, repeatedly. Like,
yep. Yep.
You said the joke, just move on.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure most of the series' budget went into that first episode, too.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. The animation was, like, I don't think I could fault the animation in that episode. Like, it was appropriate, and it was, you know, varied. We didn't have, like, you know, animation in the later scene. You had a lot more of the, like, still characters. Or anything. I think that's also, like, a symptom of the fact that it's a first episode. First episodes, almost always, the animation is going to be better than anything else because it's the thing they're focusing on.
Yeah, it's interesting because as this show goes on, this is an era where a lot of the studios were testing out CG for the first time, which we are seeing across these shows, and are rolling it out to a wide, varied range of successes.
I would not call the way it's used in this one a success.
Yeah, the two things that we see that are largely CG in this, we have CG monsters. Mm-hmm. There's some weird, like, they refer to them as spiders, but they've got, like, big, weird, pointy heads. These were very strange to look at. The big boss at the end of the show is done in CG, but perhaps, like, the most in-your-face CG in this show comes from the King's Army. You said you were going to talk about that, Eden.
Obviously, they're all just the same CG knight lined up over and over. It actually does help in some scenes, I think, just because the fact that they all look the same and they're all doing the exact same motions kind of does make them feel very orderly, but it does stand out a bit.
I mean, I appreciate it because I think it makes it feel that feels like a comment they are making, like, this army is useless because they are all the same person doing the same thing. Like, okay, yeah, cool, I guess.
There are a couple of shots where they have, like, a red model, I think, and then a grey one. And then there were a couple of shots where the same group of soldiers went from red to grey between camera switches, and it's just...
That did happen.
Other model.
I've got to say, jumping all the way to the end, the final boss monster. What the fuck was that? I'm pretty sure
pretty strange looking.
It's not only that, but, like, it's like complicated. It's got many limbs. Each one is a different limb, and I'm pretty sure at multiple times they cut off different limbs. But I don't think it's consistent between shots which limb was cut off or if that limb stayed cut off. It did at the very end, like there was a moment, like the very final bit, like they cut off the tail and then like another leg and another leg. But that's in like a sequence of shots. Whereas like we've got three or four episodes with this thing, and it loses multiple limbs over that time, and I couldn't keep track of whether or not they actually were consistent with what was removed or not. Honestly, it just looked like crap. I just couldn't process it. I hated it.
Yeah, what they're showing you, it's a mix between a kaiju and a praying mantis.
Yeah.
With a
weird, human face.
Or yeah, human mask
face. The lower
face.
Half of a human face.
It's bad. It's bad. This was not...
I wonder what it looks like in the original. Hang on.
This was not like design or inspiration from something. This was literally, we will pull that part of the praying mantis and that part of the human and that part of Godzilla and just put them together. It was bad.
They actually made him more complicated for the anime. I looked up artwork of the original, and it's just, he's all green. He doesn't have that weird gray face thing going on. He doesn't have a tail. He doesn't have all those different appendages on the ends of his arms. He just has hands on all of them.
Yeah, so probably be better. Cool. Yeah, see, that's... Yeah. Actually, we saw this in the arcade episode. This was the final boss of the arcade game.
True. So, they show you the original design and everything.
Yep. Yep. That was a fine design. Just make that again, but bigger.
So, rolling back to, I guess, episode two, where they do finally start setting things up. Jill is part of an adventuring party of climbers with his older brother. Everyone in the party thinks he sucks.
Yep.
And he ends up getting fired on his very first day of adventuring.
Because he sucks.
Understandable. Yep.
His concept is that he is a shield-style hero. The main thing you see him do is walk out in front of a bunch of enemies, stick his shield in the ground, and then go, "Arr!" as he implausibly holds them all back with this tiny little shield he's got. It's got
magic
a,
as well.
It's got a spike. How do you all feel about the spike?
I don't care. Like, my issue with all of the characters in this, particularly with the fighting, is that if we've got a show where we're going to be focusing on, hey, monster dungeon fights, cool, whatever, our characters should be able to do multiple different things. Every single character in this is a one-note character. They do one thing, and that's the only thing they do. He has his shield. He walks up, stomps his shield in the ground, and then protects something. Often fails. Okay, cool. Then we've got the lady with the spear, and it's got a cool... Oh, my God. She pulls the ripcord, and then it does this corkscrewy thing. That's the only thing she ever does with it. We've got the protecty... Like, magic-y girl, she can heal people, and she casts a protection spell, and that's it. And then we've got Fatina, like, on the other team, who is our mage spellcaster. She shoots fireballs.
Yeah, she's got a gun. Gun is her ability. She's brought to the dungeon.
Like, there's just nothing. Nothing, there's no, like, other variety to any of this. It's just samey over and over again.
Jill specifically is very funny because he has not only has a sword, it was explicitly given to him by Kaya from Gilgamesh. So he has like the hero's sword, and then he just kind of sits. Sometimes he punches people with his little shield. Also, by the way, that fucking shield, like in the first scene of the show, he has like a massive tower shield and it looks really cool. And then like the spike comes out of that and embeds it in the ground so it doesn't move. And it actually looks like it has a purpose. It looks really neat. Like, it's the whole design says, this guy has this massive shield. You're not going to get past him. He's not going to move. And then it turns out after he gets fired, that shield is now falling apart. So he gets replaced with like a dinky little buckler. That's like the kind of thing that you'd use to deflect like sword blows from yourself specifically.
If anybody's played Final Fantasy X, it is the shield that all of the characters get in Final Fantasy X. It's like, oh look, I got a little thing on my arm.
And then he puts the spike on that, and then he makes that go on the ground, and it's the size of your head, dude.
It's hard to sell it as like a party protection weapon, absolutely.
I can't believe it. I hate it.
By the way, while we're on episode two, were you watching the themes, like the OP?
Oh my God.
Was that the only person?
hang on a moment. My very first note for episode one. What the fuck is this Scar-ass opening song? And then directly underneath that, this absolutely would have been in my MP3 player in 2008.
Yeah. So my notes about that. First, I actually do think it's very funny that the entire opening sequence is like a slice of life thing that shows all of the characters in the modern day as like students, and it has nothing to do with anything in the show.
I hate it.
Second favorite thing is there's actually two OPs. In the first one,
wait, really?
There's slightly more shots of the characters like in their fantasy clothes, and then at the end, instead of Jill's current party, they showed Neva's party. And then from episode two onward, they start showing Jill's party. And also Fatina, the part where Fatina does a backflip goes from like her doing a backflip in her fantasy outfit to like her doing a backflip in like sporty revealing clothes, which is very weird. But also like, so my specific note about the scar is, in hindsight, it is very appropriate for the show. I think like it's a goofy fantasy comedy. You can't see it on this podcast, but I'm doing air quotes when I do that. But the very first scene of the show, it's like a dramatic, it's a more of a dramatic thing, right? You see this wide shot of a labyrinth in the tower. It's like very epic. There's a scene of carnage. There's like fire and corpses, and like Neba's here to check on the status of a caravan. The caravan has been killed by monsters, and they're like, oh no, something's coming. new guy, Jill, it's time to show us what you're made of. And he, like, gets out his cool, glowing fire sword. Which, where the fuck did that go, by the way? Yeah, the back. I don't know. But he gets that out. Then he gets out his tower shield and slams it into the ground. It's like, yeah, time to, you know, get to work. And then there's, like, this dramatic scene where, like, it, you can't really see what it is, but, like, something massive just flies out of this tunnel towards the group. And then it zooms in on this... Does like the, yeah, it's like this dramatic close up on Jewel, and then it goes to the theme song, and you just hear
the trumpets come in. Oh,
completely inappropriate ska.
I'm honestly past the point of debating its relevance or its, you know, like, effectiveness in the show. It's a cool song. I like it. As I said, yeah. I'm embarrassed to say this, but it would have been on my MP3 player back then. That's all I'm going to say. Honestly, I've basically just disconnected the two of them. The song's over there. Everything else about the show is over here. This is trash. Song's nice. End of story.
Yeah, so going back to the actual episode, I wanted to ask if you noticed this. The scenes where Jill interacts with people outside of his party, I have played in bad D&D games that were basically exactly like... like, everyone is rude and sarcastic, and they try to scam him, and if he looks away for like 5 seconds, someone's trying to rob him.
Yeah, someone bashes him over the head with a big rock.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, this is the moment of, oh, well, maybe he is a secret badass because he just shrugged off having a rock broken over his head.
Yeah, and people try to steal the equipment he's been lugging around everywhere, but they can't even lift the bag.
That is like the one character trait that he has. Not even character trait, the one like physicality or peculiarity that he has is that he is immensely strong. Do they do anything with that?
I wish they had done more with that. It does taper off after that.
It just becomes a convenience towards the end when he saves his brother's party and he's the one like climbing them up the thing, and it's like, okay, like, clearly, yeah, we've established this is his ability, but this has been so irrelevant throughout all of the rest of the show that I feel like they just threw it in for convenience. They animated the end bit and then went, oh shit, we haven't established he's strong. All right, in the episode, whatever it is, we'll just like, yeah, he's really a buff strong guy, actually.
In episode 9, Fatina tells him, at least in the English dub, she says, your body's too stupid to know when it's injured, which actually does fit Jill very well as a character, I think.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. What it does for him at the start of the show is that it convinces these people to join a party with him. After being kicked out of the first group, he joins up with Kaya, who is this cleric girl, who has her mysterious wants to go to the top of the tower. And then Ame, who is spelled A-H-M-E-Y, who is like an ex-soldier from the army who doesn't say much.
Nope. We do end up learning her motivation, and her motivation is that she wants to say goodbye to her not fiancé because he proposed and she didn't say anything before he died. She wants to go, like, say goodbye to her partner, which, like, honestly, that's pretty cool. I like that motivation. We learn that within a single episode, and then it kind of doesn't matter for the rest of the show.
Yes, they brush through that very quickly.
For what it's worth, I think Ami was, like, the second best character in the show, and the fact that she doesn't talk a lot might be one of the reasons.
Yeah, okay, yep. I've got to ask, who's your favourite character?
Cooper.
Yep, awesome, cool, we're on the same page. Cooper's the best?
Cooper is the best.
Cooper's yes. the
Cooper's
best.
Cooper's the fucking MVP.
Cooper is the most interesting character we've got. I feel like I want to... We're going to briefly... So, Cooper is the... is it one of our final party members? It's her, and she joins alongside her master...
Yes, she is the assistant to a wizard named Lord Melt, who is a disgraced noble who drinks a lot and complains a lot.
Yep, his fighting style is that he casts magic as if it's golf. That is a one-note joke that is the only thing he does. I can't... Again, I just... Nobody fights in any interesting ways.
I hate to say it. This paid off for me at the very end where, like, she's got this, like, caddy bag she carries around for him. He's always asking, oh, pass me the 9 iron. And in the final fight, he's like, all right, it's time. Pull out the 0 iron.
No, it was shit. I hate it.
Okay, I will say, honestly, I did write that down as, like, an idea to steal for a D&D character.
No! No!
It is funny to me.
Oh, my God.
Also, I mean, Lord Milt is a useless noble, and the world would probably be better off without him. So, of course, he enjoys golf.
Yep. And I, we, again, really just need to establish, let's see, where's my note here? Grumpy old mage with a child servant feels unbelievably wrong. This power imbalance, this fact that she mentions that her family, like, her family has always served this group of people. She's clearly not getting paid. What the fuck is going on here? She's like 10. He's like 50. There's something wrong with this and nobody's addressing it. Still, Cooper is my favorite character. Oh my god, she's the most interesting. She's got varied things that she does. Like, oh, cool, whatever. Also, I don't know how it was done in the English dub, but in the Japanese dub, she is prim and proper. Her speech style uses keigo and all the other, like, polite forms. And, like, she's a super duper polite speaking person. I should be clear. She's polite speaking. Like, she's using the formal forms. She's using the, like, lowering language that lowers herself. She's also bagging the shit out of everyone. Fantastic. I love it. It's a great dynamic. How did that come across in the English dub?
I would say the polite part probably didn't come across as much. It was just her shit talking.
She was just very sassy.
Okay.
Don't mention this too. She's voiced by Monica Rial, who we have just recently heard as Index in A Certain Magical Index, and she is doing the exact same vocal delivery.
Okay. I could see it. I don't know if I didn't look up anything. Like, it could be the same voice actors across, but again, I feel that in Index, the vocal delivery of Index is, again, not prim and proper, but, like, you know, like, polite at the very least. And I could see that being a very similar crossover here.
Sort of. Most of the time when she's, like, bagging people, it is just very obvious. Like, she's not even being subtle about it.
Oh, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. Like, in when you're listening to it in Japanese, it's basically, we've got this bit with, like, the chunk of the sentence, which is, like, this is, like, you're a piece of shit. And then we've got, like, the polite bit at the end that's, like,
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, just, it's
that bit without the polite bit.
Yeah, and it's not, she's not hiding it. It's just, like, calling someone an asshole in the most polite way possible. it's a really nice effect for me, at least. It was really fun.
I think, Coop, like, of the lines in the show that I thought were actually funny, most of them probably were Cooper just yelling at people.
Yep, 100%, for sure. Yep.
Yeah. Also, like, how jacked is she? Holy crap.
She's
like a little 10-year-old girl, and I think later on there's a scene where she picks up Utu, who's like a huge dude in full plate armor, with one hand and just, like, casually tosses him on her shoulder while carrying Milt's fucking golf clubs.
You didn't get to see the thing in the alternate first episode when we actually see all of the other characters, like, all of the other characters in during, like, for what happens to them during that flashback sequence. Cooper and Milt are, like, have joined a random party, and they've been saddled with all of the gear to carry around. It's like, you know, she's this tall and there's a big bag around her, and, like, it's a funny thing. But she and Milt have both got to carry that, and Milt's like, oh my god, I'm a weak nobleman. I can't do this. I shouldn't be doing this. So she grabs the bag and him and carries two of those bags and the golf. It's very absurd. Fantastic. Just
so basically she's Nodwick. All right.
Yeah.
This show continues split apart into these two parties because we continue following the old group that he got kicked out of, where we follow his older brother, Neba, who is, he seems like he's leadership material. But the more we follow him, we learn that he's got, like, a very dark, manipulative side to him. And he's also being followed around by a ghost of the tower, who is a blue-haired lady who pops up sometimes to taunt him.
Mm-hmm.
Does she ever get, like, a name?
Reading the Wikipedia article, like, after watching the series, that she did end up with a name. I think she's technically called the Succubus, but I don't know if they ever actually address that in this season or if that's, like, a next season thing where they mention
it. I did not hear the word Succubus, no.
No, definitely
not. No, I don't remember hearing it, but yeah. That's the party I wanna follow. This is a party that has characters with, they don't have Cooper, so that's a downside, but the rest of these characters have some kind of personality. They still suck
really
at fighting.
Utu's whole bit is he's a dude in a big suit of armor who you never see the face of, and his one bit is that he likes spooky stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. Not the best thing in the world. But this party, and even just, like, the fact that Neba is leading them is infinitely more interesting than our other party, which is basically being led by Jill, who his whole thing is that he doesn't really have actual reasons to be doing this throughout the entire thing.
It's literally a plot point later on. He doesn't have a personality.
And that's not good drive to want to continue watching this group. Neba, mysterious, he's doing shit, he's got that ghost following him, I've got questions I need answers to, whereas Jill's party and Jill's, like, drive is, let's climb! Yay!
I want to be a hero! I just realized that this is reminding me of Fire Emblem. If you're familiar with it.
This reminded me explicitly of one of the Fire Emblem games that was on the Game Boy Advance, where there's this, like, a part of it, I think it was the Sacred Stones, maybe it was another one. You end up being able to climb a tower, where there's just, like, 50 floors of this tower, and as you go, you get to collect loot and things like that. And I was like, hey, cool, yeah, that's that. I played that game. I sucked at it.
Yep.
It was more interesting than this.
I was thinking, like, Fire Emblem has that thing where they have tons of characters, and then everyone is basically, I think Brian David Gilbert did a video on it where he called them anime characters with a singular personality trait and a penchant for violence.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
That's them. Like, they even have the child soldier thing that Fire Emblem does.
Yep. Did they address it? Nope.
Mm-hmm. So as the two parties are going up, what we are seeing is, I mentioned the multiple directors last time, there is alternation between doing these very serious episodes and doing a comedy gag episode. So you've got a couple of them trying to climb this tower and fighting monsters and stuff like that. And then the sort of the tonal shift, I think it's episode 5, where it's all about a bunch of magic traps. And if you step on a magic trap, it gives you a silly costume.
Hmm. Yep.
This is,
by the way, before we get off episode 3, I think we've been talking about 3 more or less. I mentioned I took notes on every episode as I watched them. Two notes that I had on episode 3 are, there was an unironic women am I right joke in there, at least in the English dub. I don't know if the Japanese dub did it.
Yeah, I think it was Melt.
Yeah, it would have been Melt. Women. Yep.
Second note, I do not believe that nobody has punched Lord Melt before.
Yeah, he does say, this is the first time I've ever been punched. Cannot be true.
Like, bullshit.
Yeah. No, I mean, considering that he's a nobleman, it might have been he was slapped. So, yeah, I guess, on the technicality.
Also, one thing about these early episodes, there's a lot of political intrigue in them, which doesn't really go anywhere because it turns out to be setting up stuff that happens later. But then you find out what it's setting up is season 2.
Yeah.
So none of it really goes anywhere this season.
No.
Yeah. So the thing I've kind of skimmed past is that there is an assassination plot against the king that is being done by this the most blatantly villainous looking man you have ever seen,
mm-hmm.
whose thing is that he loves killing his teammates.
Mm-hmm.
Still managing to retain enough people to work as a group with him, but they try and kill the king, and Jill goes to save the king, but he fails, and he finds him there. It turns out the king is actually so strong and powerful that being stabbed through the chest doesn't actually hurt him at all.
Yep.
Also, one of the major plot points of that is Jill finds out about this plot because he overhears Neba and his party talking about it. And he thinks, oh no, Neba's gonna plot to assassinate the king. And it never occurs to him that his brother, who he implicitly trusts, who is an adventurer, might be trying to stop the plot. Like, he has to have it spelled out to him at the end.
This kid's an idiot. I don't like him. Again, I'll go back to my episode 2 comment. This kid sucks.
They fumble the stopping the assassination. They all go to jail, but then they get broken out of jail because monsters are falling out of the tower because it is the summer of Anu. This is a thing that keeps coming up over and over. There is a special thing called the summer of Anu where all of the monsters get weaker and everyone wants to try and rush up the tower while this is happening.
It's like basically an excuse for Neba to be in there at the same time as Jill, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, because the weak parties and strong parties are both going up at the same time.
I feel like this was also supposed to be a bit of a ticking clock for us, to give us a bit of, you know, excitement and pace. Yeah. But it wasn't. There wasn't any, like, indication as we go through that, like, oh, things are getting weird. Maybe the summer's about to end. It's just, like, we get to the final episodes and then, a big switch happens and somebody goes, the summer of Anu is over. Like, it's not a clock anymore. It's just whatever.
Yeah, it would have been nice if people were checking the calendar as they went on.
Exactly. How long do we think it took our characters to get from the bottom to the top? What's our guess? I want to say like 3 days.
it does not show like any kind of passage of time at all. Honestly.
No, yeah. I know we spend at least one day doing that crap arcade game thing. Yeah. The dragon maybe took a day.
I assumed there were months that just weren't shown because that tower is massive.
Yeah, but it just...
I think the closest they got was a lot of episodes started sort of in the middle of a battle with a foe you haven't seen before in an area that you haven't seen before. So I assumed that the implication was supposed to be that they'd made progress, but it doesn't really... I think like twice they mention how far up the tower they've gone. And I only remember that because the first time they mentioned it, I had to go back a few episodes to find out, like, what the fuck they were talking about. Because they have, like, a specific naming system for different levels of the tower that gets explained once.
That's the other thing. They have that explicit naming system. And so in my mind, that's saying, okay, we're going to have at least this many episodes, and we're going to be probably one episode each day, like, one episode spent on that one, getting through that thing. And then they just fucking forget about it. And they're just like, oh, I guess we're up to here now. I'm like, I don't...
Yeah,
you haven't reinforced this. I don't remember what we're up to.
This is what a better show would do. Like watching Delicious in Dungeons airing at the moment, and they are very good about being like, okay, here's the forest part of the tower. Here is the water part of the tower. Otherwise,
yeah, there's a whole part of the naming system where like the tower's broken up into levels, and then like each level is broken up into sub levels that are named after animals, and that part never comes up again, as far as I know. I think maybe like twice, once. They mention it, but it's never really important.
I think they mentioned it. They mentioned it in the ice one. They were like, "We're there. We're at the final level." And I'm like, yeah. "We're at the final. What? What? What happened to all the other ones?"
They mentioned they were in silver at some point, which is I think 2/3 of the way up the tower.
You've paid far too much attention to this fucking show.
No, because
speaking of, since we're technically talking about episode 4 right now. This is where my notes about the bathing scenes begin.
Yes.
Would you like to ask me about the bathing scenes?
What, Kaya was the first bathing scene, I believe.
Okay, so, yes, in episode 2, I think. So here's the thing. Nearly every single female character gets a bathing scene. Kaya, Atana, the side characters that are like a trio of female adventurers. Not trio, there's like 5 of them actually. 5 female adventurers that shows up like 3 times, I think. Cooper, Fatina, one of the 2 mysterious ghost girls who do not need a buff because they are ghosts. The princess in like the dream sequence in episode 1. Also Jill and Milt when they get gender flipped in that episode of the weird traps.
Yep.
They encounter a hot spring like 2 minutes later.
Yeah.
Ame and one of the other mysterious ghost girls, they do not get bathing scenes. That's it.
No, Ame gets one. Also, she was not in a bath, but she had her armor off and she was just wearing like a bra top effectively, and she was washing herself off with a sponge.
Oh yeah, you're right. Okay, so that's pretty much every character but one. Two of the male characters get bathing scenes. One is that like that one kid who he appears very briefly in episode like 11 or 12, like in a bath, I think. And I should also mention that in hindsight, actually, it's very weird that Cooper got a bathing scene because she is 10.
Yes.
But then also there's that other one where Kelb, the guy who runs the army, and like his soldiers are bathing. And the joke is that they just like they're standing there in a public square scrubbing their balls and butt.
Yep.
Yeah, and they've got a little song they sing about scrubbing your balls.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, that was in the Japanese stuff as well. That, like, it was not explicitly, like, they weren't explicit with it, but it was a soldier is good and clean and scrubs everywhere kind of vibe. Yep.
Yeah, when Fatina gets a bathing scene, it shows the rest of her party not bathing, but just fucking standing there, I guess, and talking about stuff. So they never shown bathing, so I have to assume that they reek when they get to the top. And also, out of those, Kaya, Atana, and the adventurer girls, and the princess, now that I think about it, all their bathing scenes all also include someone walking in on them.
Yep.
So basically, after about, once it got to, I think, Fatina, I started to wonder, is this like the creator's thing?
Yeah, we've got a fetish happening here for sure. For sure. I feel like I need to ask
why
you.
Why are there so many?
I feel like I need to ask you, are you okay?
No. I've watched Kamen Rider Draga. I'm not okay.
I'm worried about the fact that you've analyzed this so intently.
This is our new segment
I
on the podcast.
I should not have been taking notes on this.
New segment of the podcast. I like it. Yep.
I have like way too many notes to talk about in this podcast. Like episode 4, there's a part where Pazuzu watches Jill like in the dungeon with like an orb he has, and it never comes up again. Why does he have this orb?
He
what's it for?
Pazuzu is weird. This is our villain.
He's in the dungeon of the other adventurers. He's just following them. Why can't he just like spy on them? I don't get it.
This is the guy who loves to kill his teammates. His evil plot is that he's got these big troll monsters, and they are all carrying massive coffins which have secret weapons inside of them. You never find out what's inside of the coffin.
Because we do.
You do?
It may not have been an English dub. In the Japanese dub, they do reveal, like, not directly, but kind of, like, to the side, that what is inside these coffins are the, specifically, the bodies or spirits of the original four or five guardian knights of the original tower. The, like, the Black Knight, the whatever knight, the Water Knight.
No.
It doesn't get into it, but, like, there is, like, one or two lines where somebody was like, the spirits of the five guardian, like, people.
Yeah, I don't think that was spelled out in the English dub, although he did talk about spirits or something when he was opening the coffins, but I assumed that was part of the ritual.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter. Doesn't fucking matter. I just, like, yeah, they did address that in the Japanese dub.
Can we jump ahead and talk about an episode we've already discussed here, the one where they do play the arcade cabinet game?
Yes.
Because the setup here is that Kaya, for whatever reason, decides that it is, well, much easier to deceive Jill into climbing into this dangerous death trap than it is to actually explain it to him.
Yep.
He probably would have still gotten into it, even if she'd explained it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for whatever-
she literally uses the item she gets from it to fight Jiraga later. Like, surely she could just say, hey, the item we get for this will help us later.
No, she pretends to have a terminal illness and insists that the only way to cure it is to get this tablet from inside of this specific room.
I did appreciate the terminal illness gag. Like, it was just, like, out of nowhere dumb. And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. I'm in line with that.
I liked it. Not only does she not even bother to hide that she's lying, everybody else just goes, yep, that's bullshit, and just rolls with it.
Yep.
Yeah, because the way that this arcade cabinet works is that Jill himself has to climb in and become the protagonist. And as soon as he's inside, everyone gets control over him at the little control terminal they've got. And there is a little store that opens up that sells manuals and, like, extra coins and drinks and stuff.
The Resident Evil 4 guy comes out and goes, you want to buy some?
Yeah. They used to be arcade machines like that, I think. Like the table ones.
Yep. Yeah. They were a thing. The stand that popped up was, like, often the way that the arcades would work. Like, it would be a couple of those little tables, and then there would be a stand where they would sell snacks and candy and stuff. And that is still the case in arcade places. They look a bit different, but that was, like, from what I have seen from going to a place that was, like, a semi-retro arcade. I didn't actually go in very far, but I saw this one, and it did look quite authentic to that period of arcade, like, area in Japanese history. And then this is where we see Koopa bathing, because of course.
Yes.
Of course we wanted to see that.
Oh, that's right. The baths are inside of the shop.
This might be where I started to lose my mind about that, actually. Just, like, really losing it.
When I should be clear for the listeners, when I said we wanted to, of course we wanted to see that, I was being sarcastic. Nobody needs to see this. Please do not go and seek it out. It is not good.
So, by the way, one thing in this, so Jill's thing is basically that he is an anime protagonist. You know, he's heroic and he's a little bit stupid. And there's a bit in this episode where you find out that Jill can die in the tower, and when he dies, they just put another coin in and, like, start over. And they find this out because he picks up he gets a potion from a treasure chest, and before Ame can tell him that it's poison, he says, "What does this do?" And he chugs it. And then a few minutes later, when they finally get back to that point again, he drinks it again.
He does, yes.
Why would you do this?
I'm also just realizing now that we're actually it is breaking its own rules here by, again, he doesn't have any control of his body when he's in this game, yet somehow he drinks the potion without being instructed to.
It's, yeah.
I fucking hate this show, guys. I can't, it's so bland.
It is kind of funny that, like, this was probably one of the funnier episodes to me relative to the other ones, just because of that scene where, like, all of the other adventurers who were climbing the tower would just slowly catch up to them and just start, like, rubbernecking, and they're like, "Ooh, can I have a turn at this game?" And like, they start buying stuff and eating and drinking and just having a great time, and then Jill's just in there dying over and over. Like, yeah, you deserve that, dude. You suck.
Yeah, maybe if this show had been meaner to Jill more often and made more horrible things happen to him.
Yep. I guess that is a symptom of the multiple directors thing. Like, you know, like this director decided, hey, that's the character angle we're going for. Next director comes along, we're going to go with a different boring angle.
Skimming through your notes, since you have a lot of them, is there an episode that you would really like to talk about?
I'm trying to decide.
So I'm skimming past. Like, there's one where they fight a dragon and Jill has to convince... Well, Cooper is the one who steps in, I think, and has to try and convince a bunch of adventurers that, oh, if you kill the dragon, you can use its scales as, like, a face cream and it'll help revitalize
you. Actually, yes, I do have notes on that, actually. So there's one moment in that really stuck with me and probably shouldn't have, honestly, but there's a bit where Jill's holding one of those magic torches, right? Like, it's obviously, like, a magic-powered light source... Probably, you know, rare, they don't grow on trees. If you have one, you probably want to hold on to it. There is a scene where they want to show Jill putting a torch away, but they don't want to animate it, so they just show the torch dropping out of sight like he fucking dropped it. And Jill, put it in your pocket or something. Holy shit.
This guy fucking
sucks. It's a magic
sucks.
Torch. You put in the power source for the torch like 2 seconds ago. My god, man.
Yeah.
Also, that dragon's flame breath keeps... changing between like really big and dramatic to like just tiny little pissy fireballs depending on how hard it is to animate.
Every time this dragon opens its mouth, it costs us $5,000.
One thing I like about this episode is I think I mentioned that it was super weird how everybody outside Jill's party is just incredibly rude and mean and thieving all the time. This is the episode where they decide, maybe Jill doesn't totally suck, and they just stop doing that. That part I enjoyed. Not for Jill, for me, mostly.
Yeah. The way that they want to build his arc is that people come to like him over time because he shows his competence in putting together the dragon slaying party and, you know, protecting people later on. Yeah, he manages to save Neba's life. It's a significant moment where Neba gets ambushed by Pazuzu, who is trying to murder them in the blizzard. And he's got these... Pazuzu's got, like, rocket boots.
He's got rocket boots. That was fun. That was so fun. Unexplained. Completely unexplained. He's just got them.
That was such a waste. Like, he has these rocket boots and he has wind magic and he decides to attack Neva with a knife. Like, he doesn't even throw it. He just tries to stab him with it. Like, my guy cut Neva's rope.
Yeah.
It's right there.
They're doing, like, a mountain climbing scene and, like, one person falls off and they have to, like, catch the rope and they're dragging people up. It's stuff you've seen in better anime before.
You've seen done better in even worse anime, to be honest.
And, like, instead of going for the rope, he just tries to stab Neva in the face. Like, what the fuck? I'm trying to check if this is the episode I'm thinking of, like, the one we've been talking about. Yes, so Rocket Feet episode is also where... Kaya starts to have, like, doubts about teaming up with Jill, kind of.
Yeah, they try, like, to inject the
team
drama.
It seems
drama.
Like she has a specific goal in mind.
This is where they directly address that idea of, like, everyone who's climbing the tower has a goal, has a thing they want, and Jill does not. His goal is just getting to the top. And
yeah, he's very silly.
Somehow, this makes everyone turn against him because everyone's like, oh no, I'm a selfish person. Why are you not a selfish person? Something's wrong with you. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's like really weird to me too because the whole part of it is just everyone's climbing the tower because you get to make a wish. But as far as everyone knows, each adventuring party only gets to make one wish. So usually they try to team up, like, by shared goals and interests and that kind of thing. And then Jill's group is a bit eclectic and they all have different, you know, wants and needs. Except Cooper, I don't think we don't really get into Cooper's. Like, when Milt lists everybody's desires, he just says, Cooper, who gives a fuck? Which is rude. But then Jill doesn't really have a desire. He just wants to defeat Draugr and become a hero. And everyone's like, wow, this is suspicious. And no, it's not. That's a guy you don't have to worry about. Because by the time you get the wish, he's gotten what he wants.
Yeah, this...
Just fucking let him have that.
This is sort of the closest thing that Tower of Draugr gets to for delivering a theme. Because a lot of this is either disconnected or just running through gags and basics enough that there's not a lot strung together in terms of telling an overarching message or story here. And the closest we get is towards the end, where they do bring up this idea that everyone acting selfishly has actually brought about a positive goal, and everyone has gotten to the end and done. Like, this is Ayn Rand's Tower of Draugr.
Oh, it is. Oh no. Oh no.
There is one line, one of those lines I actually wrote down because I kind of liked it. It was, I forget who said it, but in the English dub, the way they address it is literally, there's no such thing as a hero, it's just another empty word that people use for someone after he's won his fight, and then they write legends about it. Which is like, yeah, okay, that's actually like a pretty decent point. Like, there's no one goes into the tower a hero, the hero is the person who wins and comes back.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yep.
And then they kind of drop the ball on that.
Yeah.
Also, this is the episode where it kind of becomes really clear that the army is basically just fucking great Modron marching it through this tower, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Like,
in the first few episodes, there's like these massive, like, legions of armored dudes just... You'll see them marching through a tunnel, and the tunnel stretches off into the distance, and like they're going all the way back there. And then when you see them fight, they mostly just like group up and like march forward into the enemy and start swinging their swords. And then some the people at the front die, and then more people come in. And then by the end, there's like five of them left.
Yes, especially at the very end where all of the ice around the castle on the top floor just breaks and falls away. Everyone who is left in the army just gets flushed down the toilet at that point.
Yep. Yeah.
Although, to be fair, actually, there is a brief moment in the last episode where it shows not just some of the army members, but like bit characters in the army that you've seen before back in the capital. So I think the assumption is meant to be that a lot of them got too injured or whatever to continue and they just like fucked off.
Yeah.
So at least they didn't sacrifice everybody. Yeah. It's still very weird.
Very, yeah.
Especially since like this general gets set up as a tertiary character by the end of it,
mm-hmm.
where he's someone they've been cutaway gags to, but by the end, like he's one of the ones who's there fighting in the very last battle.
Yeah, along with his like second in command, Itana, I guess, and then like some other random people. I think one of them dies, but they don't really get names, so who cares?
Yeah, they've got some flashy light mages. When they get to the 60th floor of this tower, there is this big palace up there, and they walk in. This thing is entirely empty except for Druaga? Question mark.
Yeah.
A big fuck off demon monster thing.
Who's not there at the time?
Yeah. Neba at this point it kind of gets separated from the rest of his team, and you discover that he has got these arrows that have weird blocky magic tip heads that will explode the final boss. So he goes off and there's like a fight scene like on the side because him and Pazuzu start getting into it.
It's messy overall. Like it works. Like again, my complaints about the character model of the Druaga thing, like that's confusing as fuck, whatever. But yeah. Like it's clear the different things that are happening, but nothing really feels impactful at all, so it just kind of feels like we're spinning our wheels for a while going, oh my god, this guy's strong, oh my god, this guy's still strong, he's still so strong.
Yeah, and like the last two episodes have a lot of shots of Druaga just like stomping through his lair like Godzilla, and I was just watching those and thinking, this kind of cost much money, they spent too much of the budget on that dream sequence.
Yeah, it's hard to say this guy plausibly lives up here because A, he's too big to fit in anything.
Yep, yep. He's constantly knocking shit over.
And B, like above the tower, there's like a spiky glass bit. The genius plan that they come up with to try and fight him is like, oh, you know, there's too much space down here. But if we go up to where all of the ice spikes are, there's not enough room for him to walk around. He breaks through all of the ice spikes, so it doesn't actually do anything when they fight him up there.
Oh, and while we're talking about this, spoilers, but second best character, Ame, gets killed by Druaga, and it's very sad. She lives long enough to say her goodbyes.
I have a note on this. When Ame dies, it is a sad moment. But the animation is not sad. Everyone's eyes don't look sad. Everyone's eyes just look glazed. I think they ran out of money on animation. It just isn't working for me. Like, she's dying on the floor, and, like, somebody's meant to be crying, and somebody's meant to be looking on mournfully, but it just looks like Jill looking on everything else that he's looked on, just with, like, this weird placid expression that means nothing.
Yeah, it's a very bloodless death, too, considering that she literally gets impaled through the chest.
Yeah, I think, they dragged it out a bit and didn't quite make it as vicious as it should have been. Like, it should have been an oh shit, this thing is actually going to murder us all moment,
mm-hmm.
Which instead just becomes, oh, it's so sad that one person accidentally fucked up and died up there. Back to it.
The one person who had, like, a dead, some dead guy they were pining over gets to meet him in the afterlife. Who saw that coming? Also, speaking of things that weren't animated very well, so Pazuzu's last scene, he's brought all these coffins with things that it doesn't really explain what they are at first, but he lines up all these coffins and he's obviously doing this like big magic spell to blow up Drag or whatever, but right before he gets to the end, Neeba shoots him in the back, and then when Pazuzu turns around, Neeba just shoots him in the face, which is a very funny way to kill somebody. Like, after all of their dramatic fight scenes, Neeba just waits until he's distracted and then shoots him, like, at the climax of all this talking he's been doing, which, incidentally involves just a lot of non-moving parts, just shots of his coffins and things.
Yep.
While Draga just stands there and fucking watches him do it.
Yep, yep. I somewhat appreciate that. It's kind of like, you know, the kaiju wants to just look at him like, what the fuck are you doing? You think it's going to work?
My personal theory is that Draga saw Neeba sneaking up on him and he was going to use his breath attack that he uses constantly the entire rest of the episode, but instead he just goes, this would be really funny if I just watched it.
Either that went through his mind, or it was, nah, it's going to cost a bit of money to animate that.
We are solidly into spoiler territory here, so I can tell you, after they defeat this Draga, they find out that this was only the halfway boss. Neeba steps forward and he says, haha, I've tricked you all this entire time, you fucking idiots. This is just a key, and it opens the second tower that is on top of the first tower.
Season 2, baby.
That has another 60 floors. Fuck you all, I'm out of here. Also, I'm taking your girlfriend.
Kaya basically just betrays him because she doesn't want to see him hurt, so she's like, yeah, cool, bye, not going to explain this. Off I go.
The fact that Neeba is just like, fuck y'all, I'm out, and takes Hami with him, like, and they didn't take Jill when, like, his only thing is getting to the top of the tower and killing the boss, right? He's just done that. If this kid finds out, oh, there's actually another tower that I can defeat another boss at the top of, what, you think he's going to be like, no, that's awful, but he's going to come along. This is his whole thing. He's like, oh my God, I can do it again? Absolutely, he's going to do it again. This makes no sense.
For what it's worth, I did look up season 2 a little bit. I skimmed it, so I didn't see all the details, but I got the impression Neeba's plan was also vaguely sinister, so he probably thought Jewel would attack him if he found out. I don't know.
Why the fuck is Neeba concerned about Jill? We've clearly seen that Jill, honestly, not that great a fighter. He pulls it out in the end, but with the help of everyone else. If he just goes, yeah, Jill, come along with me. Like, you know what, we get 2/3 of the way up, shank him in the back like it did with Pazuzu and just move on.
Yeah,
I think there's some scenes where it sort of implies that Jill's getting stronger over time and that, like, he might surpass Neeba soon, and Neeba's worried about that. But, I mean, sending him back to the start of the tower isn't going to help, dude.
I think it's the forethought going ahead here. Like, it has taken him an entire party to get through the first 60 floors. Another 60 of New Game Plus is going to be even harder for, like, him and Kaya, who, you know, has some cleric healing and shielding stuff, but doesn't really ever fight herself.
Yeah, and he abandons his original party members, and he could, like, Fatina's like, oh man, you told us we could get riches and then we could help Callie's village, because that guy died, by the way. And also Callie was one of Neeba's adventuring crew, who we have not talked about at all because he doesn't really matter.
No.
But Pazuzu killed him and it was very sad. But, like, Fatina's like, oh, sorry, was that all a lie?
It was very sad.
He died saving Koopa. So it was a special moment.
Yeah, like, Fatina's like, was that all a lie? And Neeba's like, yep, bye. But what he could have said was, there are 60 more levels to this dungeon. I'm sure we could find some riches in there. Because literally the only thing she cared about was money. Also, Utu. He could have just went, you know what? More riches this way.
Now, there is a romance subplot that is set up here. Like, yes. Well, they are doing... So, Neeba has been leading Fatina on. This is one of the things that the ghost heckles Neeba about. Because, she's starting to waver and is like, you know, this is going to shit. We should just get out of here. And then, like, he kisses her and says, we're going to live together after this. And then the ghost shows up and says,
"Wow,
you're bullshitting about that." And he says, oh, yeah, I'm bullshitting about that.
What a guy.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's building up sort of a bit of like a puppy romance between Jill and Kaya on the other team.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really show its head until like Fatina confronts Kaya about it.
And it's a very, it's a fairly standard anime thing, I think, where the protagonist has a love interest and the main thing they have in common is proximity.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just kind of...
Also feel like I should point out, I don't know if you guys felt this way, but I feel like Kaya and Jill both look almost the same. They look like brother and sister. And I'm going to be honest, this creeped me out throughout the entire thing. I was like, we're going to find out that you're related, surely. It's not. Like, obviously, the idea is that Ame is the descendant of the... Yes, thank you, yes.
It could have gone there, absolutely.
Ame is the descendant... Oh, not Ame. Kaya is the descendant of the cleric from the original game, and Jill is just a random dude, but obviously through his name, we're meant to find out that he's somehow related to the king-ish, whatever. But then, like, it also turns out that Kaya is granddaughter, like she is related to the king, and if Jill's name is Jill, he's probably going to be related to it. So yeah, I'm sure in season two they get into that awful stuff, but I hate it. I don't know where I'm going with this. I hate it again.
Yeah, it wants to flip the dynamic around, because you get this, one of the episodes we skimmed over is the one where everyone gets separated because of magic topsy-turvy mirror magic, and everyone gets paired with a random person, and Jill gets paired with Fatina for a while, who previously was, you know, it was part of kicking him out of the group, and it's like, you're a little loser, you're not as cool as your big brother. But they have this moment where, you know, they build some rapport between them.
I liked the premise of the episode, because it was basically an excuse to have scenes between characters that wouldn't otherwise interact much. So that is kind of interesting. You can see people who don't normally play off each other do that. And then a lot of the time it doesn't really go anywhere.
That's because our characters are very one-dimensional and they're not very well constructed.
Yeah, I was also, when this plot thing happened, I went, oh, cool, we'll get to see some fun character bits. But they rush through a lot of them, is what happens. Like,
Ame does get some cool stuff, because it establishes her backstory in this one.
True.
And that seems to be the main purpose of this.
With the general, yes.
And then, like, Callie and Utu and Cooper get paired up. Well, not paired, you know what I mean. But then it's, in hindsight, they're the only ones who get a group of three, and because Callie dies, I think we can see why, actually. But who the fuck cares about Callie, to be honest? Like, he barely, like, even compared to the others, he doesn't really have that much of a personality, honestly.
Yeah, he's got less of a personality than Night Dude, whose face we don't see.
But so this is where, like, reading a lot of reactions to season 12, where people are shocked. A lot of people were like, like I said, some of them liked it. There were a lot of other people who were quite pissed off by the ending here.
So I'm going to call you out, Defo.
What?
I got a message. I said I finished watching it, and I was, like, mad and whatever, and I told Defo that I went and looked up the ending.
Yeah.
And I got a all caps message from Defo saying, NTR ending!
It is. It is the NTR ending, and it made people super mad, because they're like, I was rooting for this couple, and now she's fucked off with his big brother.
I feel like people listening might have more internet culture knowledge than I do, but I had to go and look that up.
Oh, fuck. Okay. I'm sorry.
I hate you. Mostly because NTR stands for Netorare, and I had actually heard that before, so I knew what it was, but I had never heard of it called NTR before. But you made me look that up.
I'm sorry.
And you seemed very excited by that. Well, I'm not happy with that.
By the way, the stairs that they used to ascend to that second tower are also CGI.
Oh, really?
A lot of CGI in that episode.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess as the money's running out, they've got to fill it out with a lot of backspace there. I don't know. Every studio at this point in time is like, we're the studio that's going to make CGI look good and fine. And none of them really are, which, like, you know, I know there's still kind of a stigma against CG today, but I think a lot of shows do managed to make it look pretty passable nowadays. This was not a period of time where that was true.
No. I mean, to be fair, they were working with 2008 computers, which not very good.
Really shocked me. Even just my partner was watching the Hercules Disney the other day, and I was looking at that, watching the Hydra fight, and I'm like, wow, this Hydra looks like shit.
Yep.
Yep.
Also, got to be fair, like, high def has not been fair to things like that. I don't know if the one we watched was in high def this time, but, like, especially for that Disney one, like, high def has not been fair to early 2000s CG animation. Mm. Oof. Mm. Really highlights that clear distinction between this was the hand-drawn bit where it's, like, a bit fuzzy and stuff, and here is the very clear, precise outline of this character here done in CG.
So, this show that we have watched has held an important part in history for being the first successful simulcast, which is how we continue to watch and enjoy anime to this day.
Do you have if you have other insights, please let me know.
I have a lot of insights about episode 5, which is terrible. But the main one, Roopers kind of gets set up as a series mascot, and I don't understand why.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, talk to us about the Rooper dance.
Oh, yeah, okay, so fucking... Oh, God. Okay, so episode 5, that's the one where it's just they step on a bunch of traps that give them funny costumes or turn them into girls.
Yeah.
And all this weird stuff. There's actually a specific line in there that I wrote down. You turned me into a freaking fairy, you oaf. Yes, this was made in the 2000s. Why do you ask? But then, like, after all of these bits, and, like, this is the episode where the bathing thing is very prominent, by the way. But skipping past that, the entire last section of this is just dedicated to the best D&D trap in the universe, I think. Which is just... It is a talking door, I guess, with, like, a platform in front of it, and you have to get up onto the platform and entertain this fucking door somehow. Like, it doesn't tell you its preferences or anything like that, it just says, entertain me. And if you fail, it dunks you Nickelodeon style into some mud.
I hated this
segment. And then you can try again. That's it.
I hated this segment specifically because, just conceptually, it's a bad segment. Like, again, like, you've got the idea that, like, you know, in order to get through, they've got to do something interesting. We need our characters to fail for a bit before they actually do that, which means you're going to be showing us a series of things that sucks. Yeah. I don't want to see a series of things that sucks. I want to see interesting stuff.
There's boring magic tricks. There's a joke that ends with, that's no rhinoceros, that's my wife.
Oh, yeah. Lord Melt gets up and immediately starts on his sexist comedy routine.
Wow, these are very different between the English and Japanese dub.
Oh, really?
Okay, I actually don't fully remember what it was. So, clearly, whoever was dubbing this actually took the time to do culturally appropriate things here. But, like, I distinctly remember that Kaya's bit was just that at one point she went up on the thing and went, yeah, like a cat, twice. And
yep, that was the same thing.
Yeah, she did that.
And
she tried the same thing with a dog.
Yep. I do remember that Melt did try some stand-up comedy bits. They were not, like, misogynist as far as I remember. They were just boring.
Yeah, well, they were still boring, you know. But yeah, so basically the climax is that Jill just stands there and fucking watches them fail over and over until someone goes, hey, what are you doing? And he finally goes off, and then he has a very dramatic flashback to his father teaching him the family secret, and it turns out to be a really bad dance called the Roper Dance. And it's got, like, lyrics, so it's like, oh, take a Roper and put it on another Roper and all this stuff. And he's basically just, like, wiggling around a lot. And then they don't animate it. Like, they specifically... Okay, so, like, earlier in the episode, there are these traps that, like, turn the whole thing into the original pixelated game when you step on them. And then Jill steps on one of those on the way to performing, even though someone surely would have done it before him. And the only reason they do this is because they don't have to animate him doing the Roper Dance. And then, like, the other characters stand there and going, oh, wow, you can't see this, but if we did animate it, it would have been majestic. And then he does the dance, and then it turns out the door's already seen the dance before, so it just dumps him in the mud, and they all give up and leave, and the episode was a waste of time. But then, Jewel wonders how he could have seen the dance before, and then they do a flashback to when he learns the dance, and then it turns out that Neba was watching from the bushes the whole time. Not weird. But they then animate his dad doing the dance, and his child Jill doing the dance. So why did you have to not show him doing the Roper Dance the first time?
Why didn't
you just animate the Roper Dance and then, like, not show, like, just cut to Neba in the bushes that time or something? Like, holy...
Was the party reaction to the dance, like, was it actually that it was majestic? because
yes, they were like, holy shit, this
in,
is
they
great.
Were in tears crying at how beautiful it was.
That's amazing, because I'm from what I remember of the Japanese dub, it was, what the fuck is this, he should be arrested style reaction.
In English different. They were just, but they were bowled over. It was the greatest thing they'd ever seen.
Wow. Okay.
It very much came off as a, we did not bother animating this joke.
Yep. Yep. But then they did. Just what the fuck is this show?
Chuck it in.
That's pretty much, I mean, all of my other notes are very minor stuff. Like the time where they show Utsu in the Naruto running in his fucking full plate, that kind of stuff.
I don't remember
and
that.
I could do this for hours, but let's not do that for hours.
Yeah, this show is not worth that.
Closing thoughts, Eden?
So overall, it wasn't the worst thing I've seen. It was okay. Don't know if I'll watch season two. I might skim like the last episode and read the plot summary, I don't know. But overall, it felt like there's episodes that are all comedy, and then there's episodes that are all like fantasy action, and that's fine. Like Samurai Champloo does that, for example, but they're not great. I don't know if it's because I'm watching this like years later and I'm not in the anime club. Most of the jokes didn't land for me, and most of the action was a little bit by the numbers, I guess. Then there's like a bunch of political intrigue stuff that, again, mostly just exists to tell you that season two exists.
Yes.
Where I've heard there is some King Gilgamesh stuff, and it goes back to him and explains stuff.
Yeah, I looked
sadly,
at the...
not released in 2008, so it is outside of our ability to watch. So,
I mean, correct you there. Thank God it was not released in 2008. I looked at the Wikipedia article for the plot summary of the whole thing, and there's like King Gilgamesh, he's cursed by having done the thing originally, and that's why he, you know, survived the stabbing. But then there's a dark side of him that's now trying to take over and like dominate the world, basically a second new evil demon king. Like, fucking whatever, it sucks. With closing thoughts, this sucks.
I think if you're the kind of person who would enjoy this, you would have a better time opening Crunchyroll, clicking the isekai tag, and picking a random show off there.
Wow, that is yes. Yes,
harsh.
but true. Yeah, for sure.
I have thoughts on isekai, but again, we don't have time. This is 2008. I'm going to hold it in.
Yeah, isekai didn't exist yet.
Yes.
I mean, it might have, but not the way it does.
But again, like, in 2008, I think this would have played better. Like, there's a lot of extremely 2000s humor in it, I'm going to say. A lot of the stuff that it does would have been more interesting back then, before it was done better.
I disagree. I just, like...
I don't know.
I think if there'd been more variety to, like, the combat and stuff, I would agree. But, like, even, like, combat is the one spot where you really can afford to do different things, and they just didn't bother.
I'm trying to think of nice things to say about this.
Don't bother. It's not worth it.
We've been watching a lot of stuff from 2008 that we end up thinking, like, even the stuff we feel is pretty mid tends to have better action.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. I'm so glad that you had more notes than I did and have more to say about this than I did, because honestly, I was just going to sit here and just go, yep, sucked. But hey, yay, we've got commentary happening, not just
Thank
me
you for
being
giving
negative.
Some material to cut. Thank you for listening to Endless 08. I've been Duffo.
And I've been BJ. You can find all our stuff at endless08.com and on our social media.
If you know a real freak, tell them about the show. We'll see you next time.